Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Wall Street and Washington, Washington and Wall Street, the fiscal cliff follies continue. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Thursday, the 29th of November. And you know how every day at the bottom of the newscast, I give you a little summary of what Wall Street did. And if I can figure it out, my best guess as to why Wall Street did what it did. Usually it's just that, a guess. Today, though, no guessing required. At about 11:40 this morning, Washington time, John Boehner, the Speaker of the House, took to the podium to say this.
No substantive progress has been made in the talks between the White House and the House over the last 2 weeks.
Dow lost 57 points just like that. Good thing, then, that half an hour later, Harry Reid, the majority leader of the Senate, said this.
This is no time for delay. The American people want us to avoid the fiscal cliff with a balanced approach, and they want us to do it right now.
Mildly reassuring, so the Dow popped back up 42 points. Words matter, people, words matter. And for those who doubt Washington is watching Wall Street too, this remark before we move on. Nancy Pelosi, the House Minority Leader, waited until after the markets closed today to take her turn for the microphones. In New York City today, workers at McDonald's and Wendy's and a bunch of other fast food joints walked off the job, demanding better pay and the right to unionize. That last bit about unionizing has traditionally been tough, though, for this group of restaurant workers, as Marketplace's Dan Bobkoff reports.
Raymond Lopez earns $8.75 an hour as a shift manager at a McDonald's in Midtown Manhattan. He's one of the higher-paid employees, but he says he has to work more than two jobs to get by. Early this morning, he and some co-workers started a day of protests.
We're not asking to be millionaires or anything, but just a reasonable wage.
The protesters are asking for $15 an hour, about double what most fast food workers make in the city. And they want to unionize. Jonathan Weston is with New York Communities for Change, which helped organize today's action.
When Walmart workers went on strike, you know, workers saw that, you know, they could take on management. They could take on multi-billion dollar companies.
Past efforts to unionize haven't gone far. One problem is that fast food workers don't stay long in their jobs. Another is that many of these restaurants are owned by franchisees, not the big name chains themselves. Kate Bronfenbrenner, a labor expert at Cornell University, says this movement is trying to organize like construction workers who go from job to job.
They are organizing a fast food workers organization rather than a company by company organization.
Organizers say just a few hundred fast food workers walked out today, a fraction of the workforce. But Lopez, the shift manager, sees this as a beginning.
This is obviously day one, and the whole purpose of today is just to be heard and to make the statement.
A McDonald's spokesperson said the company has an open dialogue with employees and encourages them to express any concerns they have. In New York, I'm Dan Bobkoff for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, well, we went over that before. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If you somehow got through this past election cycle without being spammed by either of the presidential campaigns looking for money, you are in the overwhelming minority, especially Democrats, because the Obama campaign had email fundraising down to an exact science. Joshua Green writes about it in Bloomberg Business Week today. Josh, welcome to the program.
Great to be with you.
So annoying as these emails were, they work, man.
Amazingly, yeah, they did. And I think one of the kind of underappreciated stories of the campaign is that all the attention went into super PACs and how much money they were raising.
Yeah.
But the Obama campaign raised 10 times more than online than the biggest liberal super PAC did. And most of that money came in through these weird fundraising emails.
So what's the secret sauce? How'd they do it?
The secret sauce is testing and testing and testing until you find out what works.
Hmm.
They not only had a team of 20 people writing these emails.
Wow.
But they also had this vast analytics department that would study, you know, which subject lines works best. They basically did everything up to or sort of stopped just short of those internet ads where you click on the flashing monkey, that sort of thing, and optimized it to get people to give money.
What was the best subject line? Because that's the key, right? That's the thing that's going to make you open it up.
That is, yeah. And oddly enough, the best subject line over the course of the campaign was, hey. Just hey, nothing else. And there are plenty of weirder ones that work too. But you know, we all remember sort of the freaky one, like, what are you doing right now? You know, can I tell you something private? And all these sorts of things that became this kind of internet meme.
Yeah, and creepy too.
And creepy, yeah. But basically what they found was that that casual, almost over-familiar tone was the most effective. And also, this sort of amused me, that mild profanity was also effective in getting people. Yeah, there were a few emails to the extent of, you know, hell yeah, I like Obamacare,
wow,
that would kind of, you know, be rousing and sort of blue. And they worked.
Do these people know that they're basically spammers? I mean, they get that, right?
They do. The other thing that surprised me in the reporting for this piece was, I don't know about you, I stuck with the Obama email list for about 2 days, and then I was like, yeah, I've had enough, I'm out.
Yeah,
I can't stand this.
For all
I can't stand this. We're talking. Well, apparently I was in the minority, because in all these tests, what they found was there was basically no level of email spam you could direct at most people that would cause them to unsubscribe.
What about the GOP? I mean, do you suppose the Romney campaign was doing, they must have been doing the similar thing.
I don't think that they were. If you look at the tech outfits of the two campaigns, the Obama team was at least a generation more advanced than Republicans and Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney also sent a lot of fundraising emails, but they tended to be the standard, you know, please help Mitt, that sort of thing. There didn't seem to be a lot of artistry to it. But one of the reasons this did succeed, and this is really a bigger story of the Obama campaign, was that unlike Romney and previous campaigns who tend to go and hire outside vendors who do these for politicians and political campaigns, the Obama team built this all in-house with a lot of very smart entrepreneurs and tech guys from Chicago, from Silicon Valley, and kind of built this machine that not only turned out the vote, but as we see in this piece, raised hundreds of millions of dollars through email.
Yeah, it's all big data, baby, right?
That's what works in politics and I think in business too these days.
Joshua Green is a national correspondent for Bloomberg Business Week. He covers politics, as you might have gathered. Josh, thanks a lot.
My pleasure. Good to be with you.
Speaking of big data, we got an email from a listener last night that read, "Hi, I really hate that a comment from me, including my full name on your website, shows up on a Google search of my name." So, yeah, it turns out Big Brother really is watching. Virtually every mouse click you make, every search, every online impulse buy is tracked and stored and sold into the world of big data. Perhaps not surprisingly, there is a growing backlash against this data mining, people who are trying to keep their online lives private. And so, of course, in the way these things go, businesses are popping up to help them do that. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports now on the rise of data dodging.
On these nights before Christmas, all through the house, our computers are stirring. Gift spot with a mouse. As we post Facebook plans and book travel with care, companies track us online pretty much everywhere.
I go over to kayak.com, and then, you know, I'm going from New York to Miami because I want to see grandma. And I just typed in that I'm going to Miami, and now 18 companies are tracking me.
Scott Meyer heads Ghostery. It shows users which companies are tracking them on any given website.
And then I'm going to click through and find flights. Now there's 37 companies that are tracking me.
And that's in less than 5 minutes. After an evening of online gift buying, you'll easily have hundreds of companies following you. Ghostery lets people block unwanted trackers. The 4-year-old company now has 17 million users a month. Growth like that doesn't surprise Mary Madden. She's a research associate for Pew's Internet and American Life Project.
People are becoming more aware of their digital footprints and the extent to which over time, we are creating archives of various sorts.
A survey from Pew this year found 2/3 of internet users objected to companies keeping tabs on them. And a growing number of people are doing something about it, like 30-year-old website developer Josh Beauregard.
I think there is a low-level paranoia that I have of people knowing too much about me. I don't use apps if I can avoid it on my phone.
Beauregard says mobile apps are among the most aggressive trackers. He also avoids Google, Yahoo, and Bing, which are famous data miners.
I use a search engine called DuckDuckGo, which is not storing any of my searches.
Companies like DuckDuckGo have sprung up in the last couple of years to cater to the growing number of data dodgers.
There is pent-up demand for services that do not track you.
DuckDuckGo CEO Gabriel Weinberg says the data dodging industry has really started to take off. But if you're not mining data, how do you make money?
We make money the same way Google makes money. For example, when you search for, say, mortgage, we serve you a mortgage ad.
That mortgage ad will be generic. It won't be tailored to where you live or how much money you make. And some companies are finding people are willing to pay for privacy. For $8 a month, Delete Me will remove your online information from a slew of data brokers. CEO Bill Kerrigan is a former executive of virus company McAfee.
In many ways, online tracking today is far more insidious than any virus we've ever seen. It's really invisible to most consumers. They're creating detailed profiles about you and your digital life that really last forever.
Kerrigan says many of his customers don't want to drop off the digital grid entirely. They just
want a sense of control in that relationship.
I am not interested in being a ghost.
By that, data dodger Josh Beauregard means he's willing to part with some of his data in exchange for services he wants, like Facebook. He just wants to make sure he's getting a good deal.
What am I other than data in the digital realm? I am just an algorithm. If I want to feed that algorithm, I'd say, is my data worth the service that I'm getting for this?
Beauregard says you can guard your privacy online. There's no need for fright. You can surf all day long and still sleep well at night. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
If big data is keeping you up at night, Stacey's got a list of the top 10 ways that you can avoid being tracked online. You can check it out. And yeah, we do appreciate the irony here at our website. It's marketplace.org. Coming up, Dear Apple.
Is it too much to ask that the mere act of owning your products fill me with utter, unbroken contentment? I think not.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials survived the fiscal cliff roller coaster today, picked up 36 points, 0.25%, closed at 13,021. The NASDAQ added 20 points, 0.2%, 3,012. The number, the S&P 500 rose 6 points, 0.4%, ended at 1415. Investors stocked up on shares of grocery store operator Kroger after it reported better-than-expected earnings. Shares added 4.7% today. BlackBerry maker Research in Motion typed in a gain of 4% after some analysts called it a buy. The company is preparing to release its BlackBerry 10 smartphone. Shares of Guess sported an increase of nearly 2%. The apparel chain made up for disappointing earnings by announcing a special dividend for shareholders. Investors were not as kind to other retailers whose sales dropped this month. Kohl's unraveled 12%. Macy's refunded more than 4% today. Nordstrom gave back about 1.5%. Bonds rose just a smidge. The yield on the 10-year T-note thus fell to 1.62%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. Do gays and lesbians have the right to marry? Supreme Court justices will decide tomorrow whether to take up the issue. Also in Washington, the Commerce Department lets us know how much we made and how much left our wallets last month with the release of its personal income and spending report. And actor Mandy Patinkin turns 60. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. From the Census Bureau today, we got sort of a profile of the American labor force in which we learned the number one job for women in this country is secretary, and the number one job for men is truck driver, which seemed to us kind of retro, doesn't it? Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer has more.
In the 1970s, women were dancing to disco, teetering around in platform sandals. Thankfully, all that's changed. But one thing hasn't. More women work in the secretarial field than any other.
And that has been the case since we first started collecting these data in the 1970s.
That's Liana Kristen Landivar. She's a sociologist with the Census Bureau. She says today more than 3 million women work as secretaries or administrative assistants. So has anything changed since the 50s?
Oh, come on. It's not Ozzie and Harriet.
Daniel Hammermesh is a labor economist at the University of Texas.
These things are much less pronounced than they were when I watched Ozzie and Harriet in the 50s.
Hammermesh says more women are getting college degrees. He started teaching in the 70s, and his classes were two-thirds male. Now they're almost 50-50. Those degrees are landing women better jobs. In the 70s, 9% of all female workers were secretaries. That's been cut in half today. The Census Bureau report says there are now more female veterinarians, doctors, and dentists. Philip Cohen is a sociologist at the University of Maryland. He says women made great strides in the 70s and 80s, but things have stagnated since.
And I think one of the reasons why we haven't seen more progress is because women have sort of hit a wall where there's not enough flexibility at home and work.
Cohen says employers could help by being more open to flex time, and the government could step in with more public preschool programs. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
L.A. is even more about cars than usual this week. The Los Angeles Auto Show starts tomorrow. Marketplace's David Weinberg took a random walk down Figueroa Street to the convention center to see what's what.
Every car company has its own vision of the future, but nearly all of them will be accompanied by ambient electronic music. If you walked into the convention center and scanned the room, you would think that electric cars and hybrids were a big part of the market. Toyota, Honda, and Chevy all unveiled new vehicles. The head of Fiat, Olivier Francois, compared his company's new electric model to a male enhancement drug.
The blue pill element here is that it not only delivers great performance, it also lasts longer.
In reality, hybrids and electrics make up a very small segment of the market. Even 5 years from now, they expect to be only 5% of the market. One problem is price. The electric Fiat will cost about $45,000. That's three times as much as the gasoline version. And Fiat will still lose $10,000 on each one it sells. What's another option for consumers looking for affordable fuel efficiency? The good old conventional internal combustion engine.
And there's almost nothing conventional about the internal combustion engine any longer.
John Odell is a senior editor at Edmunds. He says when he started writing about the auto industry 20 years ago, experts predicted they could squeeze 10, maybe 15% more efficiency out of an internal combustion engine.
Now they're talking about, from where we are today, which is way past 15% better than we were 10 years ago, they're talking about squeezing another 30 or 40 or 50% more fuel efficiency out of the internal combustion engine.
In the most elaborate unveiling of the day, Ford brought hundreds of journalists and executives in suits out to an empty parking lot. That was stunt driver Ken Block doing donuts in a souped-up Fiesta. Starting next year, Ford will offer a three-cylinder version of the Fiesta that will get up to 40 miles per gallon on the highway and put out more horsepower than its four-cylinder predecessor. Its secret, a turbocharger.
We're going to see more downsizing of engines, the use of turbocharging to make smaller engines more powerful.
The future, it turns out, may look a lot like the past, just a little smaller. I'm David Weinberg from Marketplace.
On Election Day, voters in Washington and Colorado went for the president, four more years and all that. They also, though, voted to legalize marijuana, which is probably not the most exciting news for Gil Kerlikowske. He is the president's top drug advisor. Mr. Kerlikowske, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Interesting time, I imagine, to be running a drug control policy in this country, huh?
It is. There's a host of issues going on, not just the ones in Colorado and Washington State.
When you saw the results on election night then, did you kind of sit in your living room and roll your eyes and say, man, here we go again?
Well, we've been through this before, and I guess what's most troubling to me is to look at in Washington State, which really prides itself on its independence, it was $6 million of outside money that was raised in order to advocate for legalization. Pretty hard to compete against $6 million of outside money.
What's the story of politics in this country?
It might be.
I do want to touch for a bit on what seems to be the change of heart that the Obama administration has had on medical marijuana. The president came in saying, in essence, we've got better things to do with our time. And now in the past 2 years, there has been more vigorous enforcement, I think it's fair to say, of drug control laws from the federal level.
Well, I think it was very clear from early statements from the Attorney General, Eric Holder. Everyone has limited governmental resources, and not using those resources on people that were using medical marijuana as patients of severe illnesses would not be appropriate. And in fact, that hasn't been done. But there has been nothing that I have seen or heard from the Department of Justice that said, look, we're not going to continue to enforce federal law, and we're going to continue to take a very hard look at those people that are involved in making money on essentially what is a violation of federal law.
So will there be enforcement then in Washington State and Colorado?
Well, you know, there are questions in front of the Department of Justice. They've made some statements, and it's been very clear that federal law will continue to be enforced. And I think we'll wait and see what those decisions are from the Attorney General and the Department of Justice.
You're known not to be a fan of the phrase the war on drugs. And I wonder if that's because, first of all, it's an extremely broad brush, but also it's one of those things that perhaps isn't quite winnable.
Well, I think that it's always been a huge mistake to give people the impression that this is a win-or-lose situation, whether we talk about war on cancer, et cetera. I mean, we have to work really hard in this country to give young people the kind of foundation they need to achieve what they want to do.
But it is time to sort of put your money where your mouth is, right? I mean, in your most recent budget, the 2013 budget for the White House, the Office of National Drug Control Policy now says we're going to spend something like 40% of its budget on prevention and treatment. Where does the other 60% go?
Well, we know that we pay for the Coast Guard, we pay for law enforcement, we pay for customs and border protection. What's really important, though, is to not try and draw an artificial distinction between where the money goes, because if you look at things like community policing and drug courts, they may be seen as enforcement-oriented, but then people see the outcomes of young people being returned back to society doing a lot better than they were.
You're going to stick around for a second term?
You know, the talking points I've always been given are that I serve at the pleasure of the president, and that is clearly up to him.
Gil Kerlikowske, he is the director of the Office of National Drug Control Policy at the White House.
Thanks very much.
Thank you, sir. There are in this world people who love their gadgets and people who tolerate them. In the former category of the lovers, you'll find a lot of people who buy from Apple. Sam Weiner is one of them. He's got an iPad, and you know what? He thinks it could do more, as he wrote about originally for McSweeney's.
I hope you Apple geniuses are up to snuff, because I'm pretty sure my iPad's busted. No matter how much I use it to check email, surf the web, or tag photos on Facebook, I'm still gnawed at by a horrifying emptiness that no amount of fiddling with your magical gadget can fill. Is it too much to ask that the mere act of owning your products fill me with utter, unbroken contentment? I think not. Now, don't treat me like some tech newbie. I've done all the stuff the Apple support page says. I restarted the iPad, I upgraded to the latest version of iOS, I even sleep next to the iPad in hopes that it will turn into a beautiful, understanding woman. The iPad, like my spirit, is completely broken. Look, I bought all this Apple gear because it's all supposed to work seamlessly together, and sometimes it does. But when I download an album from iTunes on my iMac, then use iCloud to download it to my iPhone, then use AirPlay to send it to my Apple TV, no matter what song I select, the only thing I can hear is myself softly whispering, "You are garbage," inside my own head. I restart my AirPort Extreme thinking that'll do the trick, but all I get is even scarier whispering. Also, are nightmares covered by AppleCare?
You can read Sam Weiner's entire rant on our website, marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, following up on an item from yesterday, Jeff Zucker, formerly of NBC, has in fact been made president of CNN Worldwide. That is Atlanta-based CNN, which is interesting because Zucker is going to continue to be based in New York. I got into a Twitter back and forth with a friend of mine over that today over whether Zucker would be spending a lot of time flying Delta down to Atlanta and back to New York. She said yes. I said no way. He's on the corporate Time Warner jet. And then she sent me this item from the Wall Street Journal. Delta in Atlanta at Hartsfield Airport, apparently, is ferrying its very, very important flyers to their planes in Porsches. So maybe Zucker takes Delta. I don't know. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace. I would, you know. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow survived the fiscal cliff follies to pick up 36 points, 0.25%, closed at 13,021. The NASDAQ added 20.7%, 3,012. The number, the S&P 500, up 6 points, 0.4%, 1415 is where that ended. John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, George Judson, Jonathan Karp, Sylvester Monroe, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The acting managing editor is Ethan Lindsay. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back here tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.